Hey, what's good? This is Rich.
And I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to Paychecks and Balances, where we cover work and money for the millennials and beyond, and strive not to bore you to sleep.
And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at PayBalances and on Facebook at Paychecks and Balances.
And if you've been enjoying the podcast, don't forget to drop by and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, formerly iTunes, probably still iTunes for some people. If you don't know how to do that, you can go to paychecksandbalances.com/review. All the steps you'll need to leave us a 5-star review helps us in the rankings and ratings, which means we reach more people. And the more people we reach, the more people we help. On today's episode, we have another dope guest. So we're talking with Liz Weston. You want to give a little context for the people before they hear this conversation?
Yeah, Liz Weston of NerdWallet fame, I'm going to say. Great guest. And I don't think there's anything on this episode. Liz, a certified financial planner, very thorough answers that we didn't hit that you will be asking about credit scores. So credit scores and credit cards, if there's a question you have, this episode will answer.
Yeah, it was pretty thorough. So, yeah, we hope you enjoy this one, and we'll see you on the backside. And I'm just going to go with it.
And today we're joined by Liz Weston. Liz is a columnist and certified financial planner whose goal is to help us get smarter about money so we can get on with our lives. She's the author of five books, including the best-selling Your Credit Score, How to Improve the 3-Digit Number That Shapes Your Financial Future. Her question and answer column, Money Talk, appears in newspapers throughout the country, including the Los Angeles Times, San Diego Union Tribune, Palm Beach Post, Portland Oregonian?
Oregonian? We'll go with that.
All right. And she has appeared on TV shows, including CNBC's Power Lunch, Mornings with Marie on Fox Business, NBC Nightly News, The Today Show, and Dr. Phil.
Dr. Phil.
Thank you for joining us, Liz. Did I miss anything there?
You did not. That Dr. Phil episode was probably the strangest one of my career. I was helping a ghost hunter get his finances in order. So
wait,
it was very Dr. Phil worthy.
Wait. A ghost hunter?
A guy who wanted to be a ghost hunter, yes, and his beleaguered wife.
Yeah, that sounds pretty special.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah,
it was.
There are so many questions I have that I don't even try to fit them into this show. I already feel my wheels spinning, so I'm not even going to ask any of them because I have too many. I already read that.
So shortage out there.
Yeah, I'm going to focus myself here. So can you give a little bit of background for the people? Like, what does, we hear it all the time, but what does a certified financial planner do?
Okay. Most certified financial planners are helping people with their money, creating a comprehensive financial plan that covers everything. It's like budgeting and helping with credit and helping with your insurance, your taxes, getting you hooked up with an estate planner, and dealing with your investments. Now, that's what most of them do. I'm a journalist, so I got the CFP in order to give smarter answers, but I don't deal with clients day to day. Because I figured out pretty early that I don't want to be ignored to my face. You know, if you don't take my advice and I don't know who you are, it's not going to bother me. If I give you advice and you don't take it and I'm sitting across the table from you, it will drive me up the wall. So I just decided that I was going to stay a journalist, but get this extra training.
It's interesting because I hear stories of, well, from financial planners who have people that are paying them for their help and then their clients still don't take their advice. So it's like you're paying to get someone's perspective and then not taking the advice you're getting, which I always find kind of interesting.
Yeah. And a lot of the advisors I talk to, they have specific professions that they think are the worst. Like a lot of them think doctors are really tough to deal with because they're used to making decisions and they're used to being, you know, God and trying to listen to an advisor and do what they say. Very, very difficult.
Hmm. Yeah, I could actually see that because you're well educated. You're making literally life or death decisions. Someone's like, and by the way, you're spending 22% of your life. Like, I could see how I could easily dismiss that if I was smart enough to be a doctor, which fortunately I am not. So I do listen to other people.
Good for you.
But I've actually heard that sentiment. And I want to double down on that a lot, that the hardest advice, because in this avenue, we've been talking to more financial planners and also just personal finance advisors. And the hardest thing that I've heard people say is getting people to listen to the advice. The advice is generally pretty straightforward. Do you have any like go to one-liner that you said, if you do this, you know, you'll be rich, a millionaire? Is there anything, just a simple bumper sticker that you have?
You know, just to tell people in general what they should be doing?
Yeah, I think one of them is live below your means, which is like so easy and annoying that I think people dismiss it. But I mean, people like, you know, I want this complicated, you know, answer to my questions, this existential Buddha-like quote that I could only find on a meme on Instagram. And I'm like, live below your means. And then they don't talk to me again for weeks.
Yeah, yeah. Nobody wants to hear that. You know, my little hobby horse is retirement savings, because if you don't get started early with that, it gets harder and harder to catch up. And I don't think people realize it until they're like in their 40s and they wake up and go, holy cow, it's 20 years till retirement. I know how fast 20 years goes now. And once you're in your 40s, it's really difficult to catch up. So when I'm talking to people that are younger, it's like, I'm this, you know, broken record. It's save for retirement. Take advantage of the 401k if you've got it. Put in enough to get at least the full company match. Because there is no time like your 20s and 30s to get started with retirement savings. And you will give your future self so many options. But it's easy to get distracted with all these different things we have to worry about. I mean, just making ends meet, that's huge. Paying off our debt, you know, student loans is a big deal, trying to get those paid off. And it's with our attention scattered in so many different ways, it's hard to bring it back to, okay, what is the most important thing? And honestly, with finances, the most important thing is saving for retirement. Just getting started, and everything can fit around that. But if you don't get started with that, it is really, really hard to catch up later. So it's not really a bumper sticker. I don't think that fits on a bumper sticker, but put retirement first. Maybe that would be it.
I'm so glad you said get started in your 20s and 30s, because some of us, even in our 30s, yeah, haven't quite got started yet.
Now, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Time to pull the trigger. Honestly, there's so many different ways to do it. You can make it super easy. You can go to Betterment, sign up. They do everything for you. Start putting that money in the IRA. Anybody can do that. Anybody can get started, even if you don't have a account like a 401k at work.
So a lot of people may not know what Betterment is. Can you talk about that a little bit? Just what the general idea is?
This is what they call a robo-advisor. So everything that's being done is done on computer algorithms. They took a look at your situation. They have you answer a few questions. They put you into an ultra-cheap portfolio. They're using exchange-traded funds that are just like crazy cheap, so it doesn't cost you a lot of money. And they do all the heavy lifting. Not only did they figure out the asset allocation, you know, how your money is going to be spread among different stocks and stuff, they figure out when they need to rebalance so that you don't get too far from that target asset allocation, how your money should be parceled out. And if it's a account that, you know, like it's a retirement account, they're going to help you get more conservative as you get closer to your goal date. So again, it's super easy to do. They don't have account minimums, I don't think, or at least they're very reasonable. So you can get started from scratch. And there's other robo-advisors out there. They're not the only one. But if you are getting started, they're probably a really good one to get started with. And I don't get paid by them. I don't, you know, I'm not buddies with anybody on the board. I like the way that they do business. That's why I mentioned them.
Now, I've heard robo-advisors thrown around about the upside and some of the downside. So do you see any pitfalls to these services or anything that people should watch out for if they do go this route?
Well, understand that you're invested in stocks. You know, a big portion of your portfolio is going to be going up and down with that. But you have to have some exposure to stocks to get any kind of growth. You know, if you do want to retire someday, you're not going to be able to put your money into a bank account and just let it sit there. If you put it into a savings account, a CD, it's losing ground every minute, you know, because inflation is greater than the interest rate that you're getting on those. So you have to take some risk to get some return. It's okay because you have decades until retirement. So what goes on day to day in the market really doesn't matter. It's what happens over the long run. And what happens over the long run is growth. You know, we've had over every 30-year period, you know, starting in January of 1926 and, you know, every 30-year period since then, there have been like 700 of those. I don't know, but it's a lot of them. If you look at all those, every time you've gotten growth of at least 8% once it's annualized out. So every time, even going through the depression, even going through the recession we just went through, when you look at 30-year periods, you get that kind of growth. You have to be in the market, though, and you have to stay in the market. You can't just, you know, skitter out. And that's my one concern about Betterment, is that they don't have somebody holding your hand. They do try to talk you out of selling if you panic and try to sell in a downturn. But if you are really a nervous Nelly, maybe you are better off with a human being that you can talk to, you know, face to face.
Got it.
Do you have any advice for, so we talked to a CPA on a previous episode about like interviewing the CPA and basically finding someone that is really tailored to you. Do you have any thoughts on how a millennial or a younger person just getting started can determine which CFP or which service? Or I also want to talk about, in addition to Betterment, is there like any apps that you're saying, well, they're doing it really well in this lane?
Yeah. Well, let me see. Let's start with the human beings, because right off the bat, go with fee only. There are some advisors out there that call themselves fee-based. What that means is they accept fees from you, and they also accept commissions from the products they're recommending. Dirty. To me, that's like the worst possible world, you know? So I like the fee-only model. I think it's cleaner, and it can be expensive, though. I mean, this is not going to be cheap, typically. But if you are looking for a full-service financial planner, you know, you want a CFP at the minimum, certified financial planner. You want somebody who's fee-only. And then you want somebody who has other clients like you. You know, if you're talking to somebody who's dealing only with high net worth people or small business owners and you're a teacher, you know, they're not going to be as up to date. They might be able to educate themselves and make it work. But I would prefer to be with a planner who knows about teachers and who knows about teacher pension funds and, you know, the various tax breaks they can get or whatever. So looking for somebody, and also somebody you just feel comfortable with. That is huge. Somebody that you feel like you can talk to, because you're going to be shining lights into maybe some, you know, some dark corners of your finances. And I used to always kind of mentally pat people on the head, because I'd have my friends come to me. They're all journalists, and you know, all their finances are screwed up, and they'd want a referral to a financial planner, and I'd give them one, and then they'd invariably say, you know, I'm going to be so embarrassed when she sees how much debt I have. I'm going to be so embarrassed when she sees that I haven't saved for college or whatever. So I would just, like, as I said, mentally pat them on the head and say, go. Well, I finally got to the point where I needed a financial planner. And as soon as I made that decision and started interviewing people, I had the same thoughts. It's like, oh man, they are going to look at my portfolio and laugh. And actually, the one that I picked did exactly that. She said, I could see right where you lost interest, you know, based on the mutual funds that you had picked. You just sort of put it in there and just forgot about it. So, but it was a kind laughter. We worked through that. But I do think having somebody who is attuned to you that you feel comfortable with is really important. And just for the nitty gritty part, there are a couple great places to go to find planners. One is called the Garrett Planning Network. That's two R's and two T's, Garrett Planning Network. Huh. The XY Planning Network. This is a new one. It's fee only, and it tends to be for millennial planners and planners who focus on millennials. So XY Planning is another great place to look.
Rich is laughing because my last name is Garrett. And I'm also jotting that down because I'm wondering if there's some millionaires in my family that have been keeping a secret to themselves that I will be looking into at the next family reunion.
Well, this one was founded by a woman named Cheryl Garrett. She was in Kansas. I think she's moved to the South somewhere. But she was looking for, you know, people that would be willing to work with middle class folks. And that was a real problem with financial planning, is that, you know, as you got good, you would start putting minimums in of how much money you wanted people to have before you would take them on. And I was, you know, using as my sources financial planners who had minimums of $5 million and $10 million.
Nah.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, you know, if you are getting started, you need very different help from people who are in that bracket. And Cheryl recognized that need. She went out and put together this coalition of people who are willing to charge by the hour. So they're more like dentists than anything else. You know, you go in there when you have a problem, you get it fixed, you move on, rather than having this ongoing relationship where you're paying 1% of your portfolio.
I like that. I mean, that was a great and thorough answer. For apps, have you seen any of, I mean, some of the ones that we always hit on the show, Mint for budgeting every dollar. Trying to think, Rich, is there any other ones that kind of jump out? Level has come up a few times. And
Capital.
Lately... Yeah,
Capital Wallet.
Has been highly recommended. Is there one that you see that's doing well that automates the process?
Not yet. I mean, nobody's gotten to the level where I just go, wow, I have to have that, other than Mint. I mean, Mint is the basic building block of seeing where your money's going and, you know, starting with a budget, being reminded to do certain things. They're kind of got it. I like all those other apps. I mean, I like Capital. I like Digit. I've looked at Level and it looks interesting. I can't get it to work for me, so I'm not sure if that's just the situation of our finances is too complicated. Any of these things are worth looking into. There's another one called Even, and Even is trying to create a steady paycheck for you if your paychecks are not even. It's typically offered through employers, and there's a line of credit involved. So, you know, if you have a good, if you're making more than average, it puts money aside for you. If you're making less, you tap that surplus, or you can get a line of credit. I think there's a lot of really interesting ideas out there. I think we're still kind of in the learning curve part of it. I don't think there's any great solution for everybody other than Mint. I mean, I think Mint could be used by just about anybody to start getting your finances in order.
So you mentioned Digit, which was in the news probably about a month ago now, a little bit longer. They I'm sure you probably saw that they've started adding a monthly fee, which sent some people into a panic attack. It seemed like the internet was about to collapse from at least within the
not that we overreact to anything,
at least within the financial circles. But what do you say about services that have a fee, or apps like that that may start with a freemium model and then they have a fee? So you mentioned that you still like Digit, knowing that. So any thoughts for people who are kind of like, ah, free only, and so on?
I think Capital does about the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. So typically, if you're being charged a fee you don't want to pay, you look around. But everybody who's using these free models has to understand that when you're not paying for something, then the product is you. It's your information. So you have to be comfortable with that trade-off. If I'm not paying for something, it means they're using my information in some way. Mm-hmm. They're using it to pitch me products. They're, you know, slicing and dicing it and selling it to advertisers, whatever it is. So I'm not necessarily knee-jerk against fees. I think you have to take a look at it. You know, if you're paying more in fees than you're getting out of it, then, you know, obviously no. But that's the problem with all this. I take a look at a lot of the apps that get started, or a lot of the sites, and, you know, they're offering some great stuff. And I look at their business model and go, you cannot keep doing that for free.
Right.
At some point, some fee has got to come into it, or, you know, you're going to get more aggressive about selling our information, or something else. You're going to disappear or get absorbed. So that's just kind of the playing field that we're in. I don't know that there's a way around that. It seems like you get something really good and then they change it and they introduce bugs and you've got problems, or they start leveling fees that you don't want to pay. I don't think there's an easy answer to it, other than you can always shop around and understand that anytime anything is free, the product is you.
Message.
I appreciate you saying that, because I am a millennial, and even as one, I'm an older millennial, I should point out. I'm like right there on the cusp, right there before X. So not quite as bitter as the X's, who are actually upset that no one ever talks about them. And all millennials do is complain that everyone just talks about it. That being said, it's confusing to me how upset we get. Like, it's like, yeah, I'll hand over my social security number, but I draw the line at paying a $5 fee. Like, I don't think that folks get this handoff of like, yeah, you're usually showing, you're either selling your data or you're selling, you're buying ads. So personal capital, I think their model, I'm actually not on Personal Capital, I've heard good things about it. Their model is, as I understand it, is the app and website are free, but they do try to sell you investment portfolios or investment advice. Mm. That I understand that's how they make their money. Yeah. But I don't get this, like, everything should be free. Like, yeah. even when it has tangible value. For example, I saw a tweet yesterday, it made no sense to me, and I'm going to get back on script here, but it was essentially, Twitter should pay us to be on here. I'm like, that's stupid. No, that doesn't make any sense.
Okay, and I'm like, sit everybody down and have them take an Econ 101 class. Right.
I'm like, only a millennial could write that. And it had a whole bunch of retweets. That's what made me more upset. I'm like, who is endorsing this? So, like I said, let me get back on script. I want to talk a little bit about credit cards and credit score as well. So your book, Your Credit Score, what is the takeaway from the book? Why did you write the book? What are people going to get away from this?
Well, I wrote the book. The first version was back in 2004, you know, back when dinosaurs roamed the earth and people didn't know what a credit score was. So the initial mission was just to explain to people what these scores they were hearing about were. And you got to remember, not too long before that, we actually weren't supposed to know that credit scores even existed, let alone what ours were and what went into it. Yes, there was an agreement between FICO, which is the leading credit scoring company, and all the lenders they supplied these scores with, the agreement was you do not reveal these to the customer. So it was supposed to be background black box kind of thing. But as they started being used in mortgages starting in the mid-90s, suddenly people started hearing about it and being curious about it. So there were back then a bunch of myths about what went into your score and what didn't. So I decided to sit down and kind of, you know, okay, here's what's real, here's what's not. The funny thing is, through five editions of this book, the chapter about myths hasn't changed at all. It's the one chapter I haven't had to rewrite at all because the myths just stay there. It's like, carrying a balance will help your score. No, it won't. Closing accounts will help your score. No, it won't. So there's all these things that people, you know, think they understand about credit scores. And it's great. People know what they are now. That's awesome. And people know in general, you know, what goes into them. But how they're being used is still, I think, a big mystery. And I think right now, we just did a, NerdWallet just did this survey about credit and credit scores. And we found so many people did not know that credit scores are used by utility companies to determine how big your deposit is. Your cellular company, T-Mobile, said that half of its customers could not qualify for its best promotional rates because of their credit. So your wireless company is using your credit. Insurance companies, this is huge. Your credit score or a version of your credit score is being used to set your premiums for car insurance and homeowners insurance. And it's a big factor. I mean, Consumer Reports went in there, did this really great study a year or two ago, and found that your credit score can matter more than your driving record in terms of what you pay. And the difference between having a good score and an excellent score can be hundreds of dollars a year. So this is something that's kind of taken over kind of in the background. And a lot of people don't know that's going on. And even like, I think a quarter of the people we surveyed didn't know that their credit score could affect whether they could get an apartment or not, which tells me they haven't gone and applied for an apartment right. anytime lately. But, you know, your credit information is out there. It's permeating your financial life. You need to know how this stuff works and you need to pay attention to it.
So a couple of questions in mind. One, you mentioned how even credit score can impact utilities, renter's insurance, other insurances. Is any guidance around how being late on some of these other services, even though it may not directly hit your credit score, is there any impact on that? So, for example, someone pays their cable bill 2 or 3 weeks late all the time, or their utility bill collects for a couple of months before they make a payment on it. Are there any repercussions to that, given that they're not directly lines of credit, but you're still delinquent?
Typically not yet. Is that vague enough for you?
Yeah.
Right now, the FICO, like I said, the FICO is the most commonly used score. VantageScore is the rival. That's the one that you get for free typically when you go to a site and sign up.
Yeah.
Both of those are drawing on pretty traditional credit report information. There are alternative scores and alternative credit bureaus that are collecting all that information. What those alternatives are trying to do is basically make the tent a little bigger. They're trying to find creditworthy people who don't generate credit scores. They don't have any credit accounts. They don't have credit cards or loans or whatever. So paying, if you are trying to sort of build and get into the world of credit with these alternative means like paying utilities or paying rent or whatever, that could be taken into account by these alternative scores. But right now, your FICO, the FICOs that most lenders are using is not taking that information into account. So I'm actually writing a column about what to do when your emergency fund runs out. And one of the things we talk about is in a lot of winter states, they will not turn off your utilities in the winter. So you actually have, you know, 5 or 6 months where you cannot pay your bill and then catch up when you get your tax refund or whatever. Not the way I recommend running your financial life, but if you are in a spot, you know, that's a way to go. As long as it doesn't get turned over to collections, it's probably not going to hurt your credit scores.
Got it.
But if you do the same thing with your credit card, you are going to watch your scores plunge overnight. They are not nearly as forgiving.
Got it. And so the other questions, there are these services that are out there now where they talk about pay your rent to build your credit history. Any thoughts? First, are you familiar with those? They're kind of like rent tracking services. So do those actually work?
Well, my colleague Bev O'Shea just wrote about this for NerdWallet a couple of months ago. And again, these are the alternatives. These are not, the information's not being used in the credit scores that most lenders use. The latest version of the FICO is called the FICO 9. That does include rent information, because the rent information is showing up at the credit bureaus. Now it's becoming more mainstream. But the FICO 8, which is the most commonly used score, doesn't include that. So you can be paying your rent, you know, month to month, and then paying extra to be included in these credit, these alternative credit bureaus. And no lender is going to see a score that takes that into account, at least not yet. I mean, that could change. But my concern about these, you know, the pitches I see for these, you know, pay your rent, get credit, or build your credit, is they're not being clear about that. They're not being clear that they are way ahead of the curve at this point. So we go back to the same advice. If you want to build your credit score, you have to do it using traditional credit, a secured card, a credit builder loan, something like that to get you started.
Makes sense to me.
Yep.
And we've mentioned this a few times, but I'm actually fairly confident or know that this is going to be shocking to some people. Is there even a set amount of how many credit scores are out there? I think most people just think their credit score is the credit score. And
yeah.
Isn't there some ridiculous number? Oh, like over 10?
Well, no, I think we have hundreds of scores. I mean, once you break it down. And part of that bad credit survey that we just did, there was a significant minority. I want to say, like, you know, somewhere about 1 in 4 people thought they had one score. And you don't. You have many, many scores. They change all the time. So let's see if I can condense this as much as possible, because, man, it gets complicated fast. All right. I've been talking about FICO. That's the leading credit score. Okay. The FICO 8, that version, is the most commonly used score. However, there are different generations of the FICO score, and there are different versions of it tweaked to different industries. So, and there, of course, are different scores based on which credit bureau you're going to. So you might have a auto score 5. You know, your lender might use an auto score 5 from Experian, which is going to be different from the bank card 8 that would be at TransUnion. I mean, we're talking so many different versions of this. I did a post for my blog a couple years ago where I pulled all my score, or many of my scores, from my FICO.com. If you go there and you pay $60, you get your FICO 8s from each bureau, and you get the 5 or 6 most used scores from those bureaus. And they are on different, and these are all FICOs. You know, we haven't even gotten to VantageScore or the other scores.
This is crazy.
And you know, there could be a 100-point difference, because, you know, the auto scores are on a 250 to 900 scale. The regular FICO scores are on a 300 to 850 scale. So it gets really, really complicated really fast. And then, as I said, the VantageScore was created by the bureaus as a rival to FICO. So it's not used nearly as much, but it's the score you're probably going to see if you go pull a free score. Like on NerdWallet, we have a VantageScore 3.0 from TransUnion. Again, you know, it'll give you a general idea of where your credit is, but it's going to differ from the scores that your lenders see. And then this is the most important part. Mortgage lenders use old scores. Mortgage users use the equivalent of Vista. You know, if you're familiar with Microsoft and the various iterations of the operating system,
yeah,
they're using a score that's like 4 or 5 generations out of date. So it's going to be, it can be very different from either the FICO 8 you're looking at or the Vantage score you're looking at. So are you completely confused now? And if you aren't, you're not paying attention.
Well, I think the because, well, one, when you were like, there's credit score 5, I'm like, I've never heard of that. And you're like, there's the FICO 6. And I'm like, I've never heard. I'm becoming very insecure about what I know about credit. I thought I knew a fair amount. And so I access Credit Karma, and Credit Karma provides the Vantage score, which I noticed that those scores do differ from some of the scores that I see when I, like, if I log into my credit card account and it says your new score is ready. So I think the takeaway for people is, don't become too reliant on one number. Just because your number shows up good in one place doesn't mean that it's showing up good in other places. But at the same time, don't feel like you need to run and track down 20 different scores. There's really a couple that you need to be concerned about.
Well, that's a really good way of putting it, because a lot of the banks now and credit card companies are offering you FICOs. So you can take a look, and maybe you're looking at a FICO 8. I think my bank gives me the bank card 6 or 2 or something from one of the bureaus. I can't even remember. You know, and I do this for a living, and it's hard to keep track. But the thing to keep in mind is, if you are in the market for a major loan, like a mortgage, you're going to want to see at least the same scores in the same ballpark that those mortgage lenders are looking at. And that's not available for free that I know of. So if it were me and I was going for a refinance or a mortgage, I would go to my FICO and I'd pay the money to take a look at what those scores are. So I have a good idea what to expect. And the other nice thing is on my FICO, they have kind of ongoing information showing you what interest rates you can expect based on your credit score. And that's really handy information to have when you start going out there and shopping, because you can tell kind of if you're getting the deal you should be getting versus getting snowed by a mortgage broker.
Got it. So this is a lot of great information and still a lot more to cover. But before we do, we're going to take a quick break. Billing clients is one thing. Getting paid on time is another. FreshBooks makes it easy to not only send invoices in less than a minute, but to also send automatic reminders when you haven't been paid by the due date. This means you don't have to mash your keyboard with angry fingertips as you calmly type, "Yo, what's good with my money?" FreshBooks will automatically do it for you according to whatever schedule you set up. To get a free 30-day trial of the cloud accounting software we use, visit paychecksandbalances.com/freshbooks and enter Paychecks and Balances in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Type softly, my friend. And we're back.
And so I have two questions. Would it be fair to say that positive habits raise all the scores? Is there anything unique you need to do to impact one score or another?
Oh, that's a really good question. As I said, the mortgage scores are several generations out of date. So they will reflect if you have paid collections, for example. And the newer versions of the score might ignore that. So what you want to do in any case when you go get a major loan is go pull your credit reports, because that's what the score is based on. Whatever score they're using, it's based on a credit report. And go over that and look for any errors and look for, sometimes if you have a paid collection, you can just dispute it, say, "Not mine," and it'll disappear. Typically, you can't get true negative information to go away, but sometimes with a paid collection, that'll work. That's the only thing I'm thinking of that pops to mind. In general, the way you get your scores good and keep them good is by having and using credit. So you want to get that credit card, use it lightly but regularly, pay it off in full every month. There is no reason to carry credit card debt. It does not help your scores. It's stupid. Don't do it. And then there's also something called a credit builder loan, which I referred to earlier. These are loans offered by credit unions and one online lender that I know about. And you're basically, you get this loan and they, rather than give you the money, they put it in a savings account. And then you make your payments for a year and then you get the money that's in the savings account. So it's a way to kind of build an emergency fund and build your credit at the same time. And if you're starting from scratch, you can get to the mid 600s, which is a decent score. It's not a great score, but a decent score. Just with one of these loans, if you added a credit card on top of it, you could get to 700 within a year. And that's starting from scratch. So that's no small deal. And the other thing you need to keep in mind with credit scores is that you don't want to use a lot of your available credit. The credit scoring formulas like to see a big gap between the amount of credit you're using at any given time of the month and the amount of credit you have. So 30% or less of your credit limit is good. 20% or less is better. 10% or less is best. So you want to keep an eye on that. And then the third component is just pay those bills on time. One skipped payment can knock 100 points off your score.
Oof.
It can drop you from excellent to merely good or even mediocre. So this is something you really want to pay attention to. I'm not talking about paying late, a week or two late, not good, but that's not going to show up. It's the 30 days late that will really get you.
Open your mail, people. Open your mail. That's gotten me in the past where I just let mail pile up and there was a bill that I forgot to pay. And then next thing you know, I'm having to scramble and call someone and beg them not to send it to Experian or one of the other bureaus. So open your mail, people. Open your mail.
Yeah, and if you screw up like that, then you call and try to get some accommodation. But I have the attention span of a 3-year-old. I have to have everything on automatic because I will forget. It's just, and I'm also one of those people that chases rewards. So I have like 12 different cards going at any given time. There's no way I could keep up with that. So I just put everything on automatic. It gets paid. I don't have to worry about it.
Nice.
Yeah, I had an experience. Unfortunately, I tried to tell a quick story. I don't even want to share it. You can hear the excitement in my voice. But I was probably in my early 20s, I paid, well, I missed a payment. Same thing with Rich. Then, you know, mind you, I'm old. So this was like mail. Snail mail came in the mail. I missed it. I missed a payment. It was my fault. Not only did I actually wasn't even monitoring my credit score at that time, but my interest rate like quadrupled. It went from like 39% or 29%, something ridiculous. So I called them up. I'm thinking, hey, I've been a loyal customer for 5 or 6 years. There's obviously been a mistake here. And they were like, nah. So then I got so upset, I closed the card, which I also didn't know messed with my utilization rate. Yeah,
take that.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, take that, stab self in back. So yeah, whatever you do, folks, you know, remain calm, do as I say, not as I do. And yes, I definitely agree with the 30 day, because that was something else I didn't know. And Rich and I talked about this on another show. A lot of those 0% interest cards, if you don't pay them off during the well, this was for furniture. So like, let's say you buy a couch, I think was a specific example. If you didn't pay it off in that 36-month window, didn't I save you, Rich? Because I was like, hey, you might want to make sure there's not a balloon payment if you don't pay it until the 37th month. And yeah. I think on the next show, he was like, oh. But, I mean, those terms, they're called fine print for a reason, and not because they're beautiful.
That's awesome. Yep. And the 0% deals, you really have to pay attention to when it expires, because I think they kind of count on you losing track and at least, you know, winding up paying those triple digit or double digit interest rates for a month or two before you go, oh, God, I didn't intend to do that.
Yeah, I was I definitely ended up paying triple digits in interest every month. And it started that way. It initially started with, no APR a year. And then I'm like, I'll pay it off. And then there was a balance after that year, and then all that interest came back, and then it got out of control from there.
Yeah.
Classic story, yeah. I guess.
It is, unfortunately, and that's how we learn. You know, they say good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. So there you go.
There it is.
The book also mentions social networking risk. Can you expand on that and how that might affect your credit cards or credit scores?
Well, that comes in a couple different ways. One way is that, you know, we share so much on social media that if anybody really wanted to hack into our accounts, we're probably giving them all the information we need. You know, your birthday should not be out there for anybody to pick up. That's one of the keys to your identity. Huh. Pet names, don't use them as passwords. So many people do, or your children's names, birthdays of their children. There's just a lot of information that we're sharing that's probably not a good idea. Would make it easier for someone to hack in. And you know those stupid security questions, which to me are an oxymoron. There's nothing secure about them. I wrote this story, and I was talking to my editor, and I boasted, you know, I could find out your mother's maiden name really easily. And he's not on social media anywhere. And, you know, so I took it as a challenge that he didn't think I could do it. I found his mother's maiden name in less than 60 seconds.
Oh,
I thought you were going to say you came back with a loan in his name.
I probably could do that too. I
told you.
You know, charge something to his American Express account. I mean, there's so much information out there. And again, this is a man who was not on social media, but all his relatives are. And it didn't take me very long to just kind of focus in. So I'm sorry, I went off on a rant there. But those security questions they ask, they're really easy to reverse engineer based on information out there in social media.
I didn't mean to cut you off there, but I've thought to myself, like on Facebook, I'm like, happy birthday. I'm like, everyone knows my birthday now. So if someone wanted to start some application, they probably could. And my profile also shows where I went to high school. And that's a very common question.
Yeah, your mascot for high school.
I just by saying this, I need to now go update something because I've clearly divulged too much here. But you're right, and I've had that thought to myself before. Will someone really go after this information? But it's something that happens to people every day. Like you could just be, there's someone that could just be following along, and you think nothing of it. You know, maybe they don't even have a picture, and all they're doing is collecting information.
And we're talking about strangers there. If you really want to get messed up, you know. Have an ex go after you, an ex who knows any information about you. It can get ugly pretty fast. But one thing we can do, in addition to trying to limit the information that we're sharing, turn off the birthday thing. I know it's cool to get all those birthdays. Maybe get it a few days before or after so you can still get the buzz. But in addition to that, you know, turn on what's called two-factor authentication. or verification. It's a pain in the butt, but it's that one step that's going to help keep hackers and bad guys out of your business. So Google has it. Most of a lot of the financial institutions will have it. It just is a way to ensure that you are you. And it's called two-factor authentication or verification. You can go out and search on that term and find out a lot of information about it. But it really is, at this point, with so many breaches going on, with so much information out there, anytime you can turn that on, you really want to do that.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the breaches. Well, I guess it's not really funny to me, but I got one of those automated calls yesterday that my account had been compromised. And I don't know where or when, but they're sending me a new card. And, you know, there's going to be situations where there's absolutely nothing that that we can do about it except take all of these precautions for ourselves. And then even then, there's still going to be situations where maybe an institution, their stuff wasn't as secure as it needed to be, and your account gets compromised.
Yeah. And here's a pitch for using a credit card, because your liability in those situations is zero. You know, you are not going to pay for those bogus charges, and they are monitoring your transactions. And sometimes they screw up. We just had a situation where we went out. We actually, my husband's an artist. We bought a piece of art. It was not cheap. It went through, no problem at all. We tried to use the same card to go to dinner, and it got stopped. So their fraud detection software has something to be desired, but at least it's there. It's trying to help you. If you're using a debit card in those situations and it gets compromised, that money's coming directly out of your bank account. You've just given the bad guys a route right to your paycheck, essentially, all the money in your life. So, or most of the money anyway, for most of us. So it's anytime you can use a credit card rather than a debit card, I would. You just have to pay attention and pay it off. You know, you don't want to be charging more than you can pay off in full every month. But you really do have more protection with a credit card than you do with a debit card.
Yeah, I don't understand this. I like to not mention the institutions by name, but I have a large banking institution I work with, and I have a credit union.
I thought you were going to say you have a large bank account. I was like, oh, listen to you, humble bragging on the show.
No, I have a small bank account at a large banking institution, and they make more effort to keep me from my own money than I've ever seen. It's actually impressive. Like, they send me text messages like, hey, are you sure that you want that candy bar? And I'm like, yeah, man, let it go through. And they're like, yeah, you can use it in 5 minutes. And I'm like, all right. But then the same account got hacked and somebody withdrew like $2,000 in 500 increments. I'm like, really? Like, this is what you don't stop? I mean, I got it all back the next day. Like, they just called. And the messed up thing was, in this scenario, they always text me. So I'll use the card and it'll text me like, hey, are you at the grocery store right now? I'm like, ah, you know, which I'm in line at the grocery store, embarrassed right now, responding to the text. And then it'll go through. This time they emailed me. They're like, hey, someone, a suspicious email withdrawal from 5,000. So I didn't get it till the morning. What is going on here? Who is writing these algorithms? I just feel like it's somebody disgruntled behind the scenes.
There are flaws.
How can I meet this protocol, this TPS report, without notifying the customer who might call me?
I was going to ask if Liz, if you've been hacked.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. I've had countless cards get compromised, and we did have this situation where, you know, there was a problem with the iTunes accounts for a while. They were getting really hacked hard, and I had this one credit card we hadn't used for a while, and I opened it up to look at it online, and we're like, oh geez, there's like $200 on iTunes 1 month and $300 on iTunes 1 month. Oh geez. And it went back for like 6 months. So I quick texted my husband and I said, hey, we got hacked, just to let you know. And he sends back this text and he goes, when did those charges start? And I look back and I said, November. I set a date in November. And he said, well, that's when you gave me my iPad. So he'd been out charging up books and music and all this other stuff. It's like, really, honey? $200 a month? Like, yeah. Great music out there. Like, oh.
Yeah. Rich knows that pretty much every Sunday I'm looking back at my checking account like, someone, I'm hacked. Fraud. I've usually dialed the 9 and the 1 before I realize it was just me. I'm familiar with that story.
Yep.
So you have two articles. I'm going to plug these in the show notes for the listeners. They are How to Bounce Back from Bad Credit and How to Pay Off Your Credit Card Debt. Can you talk a little bit about how secured cards can help benefit people in paying back or improving their credit?
Yeah, basically, if you have had, you know, rough credit in the past, you've had problems, or if you're trying to start credit, you look for a good secured card And we've got a list of them at NerdWallet. And they, what they do is you give them a deposit, $200, $500, $1,000. And then you get a credit line in that same amount. And it's not like a prepaid card. You do have to pay the bill when it comes, even though you have that money on deposit. But if you do that and you use it consistently and lightly, pay it off in full, you are building credit with the three main credit bureaus. And that will help you get started and help you overcome some of the, if you've had troubles in the past, help you overcome that. You want to be very sure that you pay it, and you want to be very sure you pay it on time. And you don't want to use more than maybe 30% of whatever limit you've got. But it's a really good way to get started. And then again, as I said, those credit builder loans from credit unions are another way to help get your credit going if you've had problems or you just need to. You know, we have a lot of people coming in from other countries that don't, you know, they might have great credit in whatever country they're coming from. They come here and, you know, they're starting from scratch again. So this is ways for people who are new to the country, new to credit, or that have had bad credit to get going.
Yeah, I like that a lot. We've had a couple of questions on that, so I hope that'll help the listeners out. And I have recommended, and I think you speak to as well, an installment loan, sometimes also called a consolidation loan. Do you have any thoughts on how that can help people either better manage or improve their credit score?
Debt consolidation loans get really tricky really fast because in my experience, when people are starting to look for a debt consolidation loan, they're already in too deep. So not necessarily a good way to build your credit. I mean, any installment loan can help you, but debt consolidation loans in particular, you want to take a look at how much debt you've got. I mean, if your debt, your credit card, medical bills, whatever, is half or more of your income, you are in deep trouble. You know, it's a loan. Another loan is not going to help you out. If it's more like 15 or 20%, yeah, maybe that could work. But my experience is that when people are asking about debt consolidation loans, they're trying to bail themselves out of a situation where they're already in too deep. So maybe they should be talking to a credit counselor, National Foundation for Credit Counseling. Maybe they should be talking to a bankruptcy attorney. You know, maybe they are struggling to pay debt they are never going to pay. So that's my first reaction to debt consolidation is, you know, make sure you actually can make your situation better before you apply for any loans.
I like that. And I like that you've put some utilization to these. I think people get confused on when do I know when to move to these different decision makers. So I think that's a very clear barometer. Like, is it 50% or 30%? 30% move forward, or at least make that informed decision. Because that's kind of what I try to tell folks, that a lot of these questions they're asking, they get upset with me because I'm like, well, it's complicated because
yes.
It's a personally tailored situation. It literally, it puts the personal back in personal finance. Yeah. But I like that. I'll actually be using that going forward. Like, what utilization are you at right now so I can recommend better options? So I appreciate that.
And, you know, it's nobody likes the answer. It depends. So we try to come up with a lot of these rules of thumb, shortcuts, whatever. But it also has to do with age. And I want to drop this in because if you're a millennial and you have a heavy debt load, you know, you have decades ahead to pay it off. Your mom or dad, they're approaching retirement age. They have the same situation. They should be talking to a bankruptcy attorney because they don't have the decades ahead to pay that stuff off. And I just dealt with this with a friend who called up, and she was asking, you know, where she could get a debt consolidation loan, which sends up all the bells and red flags. And I said, okay, what's the situation? She told me, and I said, here's the name of a bankruptcy attorney. And she was actually relieved because she was trying to do the right thing. But honestly, there's a certain point where it doesn't make any sense, that you are just going to continue to struggle and struggle and struggle. And the credit card companies are not going to struggle. If you can't pay your bill, they're going to, you know, if you file bankruptcy, they're going to be just fine. The question is, are you going to be just fine if you don't? And a lot of times the answer is no.
Appreciate that.
We also had a listener question that we wanted to cover with you. And so today's Q&A is sponsored by FreshBooks, the super easy to use cloud accounting software designed for the small business owner. If you bill by the hour, it even has tracking built in so you don't have to start a timer elsewhere. And of course, this is hashtag clutch. To get your free 30-day trial, visit paychecksandbalances.com/FreshBooks and enter paychecks and balances in the how did you hear about us section. And so we talked about this one a little bit up front, this idea of 401k loans, which I know you love. And so we had a couple of listener questions. One wanted to use a 401k loan to pay off a credit card sooner. So they were basically saying, if I get this 401k loan, maybe I can pay it off in 4 years versus paying the minimum since I don't have any extra room in my budget and having to pay it off in like 15 years. And then the other was advised by a family member to take out a 401k loan for living expenses since they're living in a city trying to pursue their dreams. They're actually in LA, so they're trying to break into the entertainment industry. And they've already been there almost 2 years now. They haven't gotten a full-time job yet. And their mom was like, you know what? Pursue your dreams. Take out a 401k loan. So what do you say to these folks?
Well, in general, no. No. I mean, we can talk ourselves into 401k loans because they seem like there's a lot of great reasons. You know, you don't have to do a credit check. You're paying yourself interest, yada, yada. Here's the deal. If you lose your job, you have to pay that balance back quickly. And if you don't, it becomes a withdrawal. And withdrawals are very, very, very bad. You are paying a quarter to a half of what that balance is going to be paid to the IRS and to your state tax authority in penalties and income taxes. So you just wiped out a huge chunk of what you borrowed, and you've lost all the future tax deferred compounding that money could have earned. And figure that if you are in your 20s, every $1,000 that you take out of your 401k now is costing you $20,000 or more in lost retirement income. So it's just hugely expensive. And we have the statistics. We know when people lose their jobs, 90% of the time, they do not pay back that balance. So that's just, to me, it's a huge risk. Who's got a secure job that they can say, oh, you know, I'm not going to lose my job in the next 5 years. So I'm not going to have to pay back this balance. I don't know of anybody in that situation. So to me, it's just a crazy risk. And why would you do that? I'm going to say to the guy in LA or the person in LA, because I'm in LA and I know this, I've seen so many people ruin their lives trying to pursue a career in the entertainment industry. Don't make it worse by tapping your 401k. And if you're not actually working for that employer, and it sounds like he's not, you can't get a loan. You know, you basically are making withdrawal, and that's even worse. You know, you're getting all those bad consequences without any of the possible positive reasons. And the guy with the, or the person with the credit card debt, yeah, I understand. But if you can't pay the minimums, or you're having trouble paying the minimums on that debt, you've already got too much debt. Getting another loan is not going to help that. You're just putting your retirement at risk now. So if you're having trouble paying the minimums on your debt, go talk to a credit counselor, go talk to a bankruptcy attorney, because that is an unsustainable situation. And you are not going to make that better by getting another loan.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned the piece around leaving your job, because in my last job, I had someone, so I work as a technical recruiter by day. I was negotiating with somebody who was looking to leave their current company. I guess that's why you interview, because you want to leave, not versus just find out information. And what ended up coming up with this person at the end, they realized after they accepted the offer that they had a 401k loan they had taken out to buy something. And they had an old crap moment where they were like, yeah, if I don't pay this back within X number of time of leaving my current employer, I'm going to be on the hook for X amount of money. Can you guys help me with this? And at the time it was like, no, that's your fault. we're not going to help you. we're not going to help you out because you made a bad financial decision. And so yeah. I'm sure that person is still in New York somewhere, but it's another reason to really think about that, because if you're switching jobs and you're like, you know what, whatever, this is good, I'm making more money, but you've taken out a 401k loan, now you're in a situation where you're scrambling to pay it back, which might actually eat up any pay increase that you were supposed to get from the next job.
Yeah, and it just ties you. It's another tie to an employer that you may not want to have. So it's just, in general, I used to think, well, maybe there are situations where a 401k loan makes sense. I don't see it. Most of the time, people are talking about borrowing this money when they shouldn't be borrowing the money at all. You know what I mean? They're saying, oh, it's better to borrow from this than to maybe, you know, get an auto loan. Well, maybe it's not time for you to get another car, or maybe it's not time to get the car that, you know, that brand new car that costs $30,000. Or in this case, the guy's got problems with debt. If he cannot pay his minimums, if he's struggling, that means he's already in too deep. So yeah, he could take out this loan and maybe give himself a little breathing room, but then he loses his job, or he wants to change his job, and he's just created a bigger problem. So in general, I mean, just look at your retirement money as not being there. You know, it's not available to you. It's not accessible. Pretend it's not there. Leave it for your future self, and your future self is going to thank you.
Nice.
And I wanted to repeat both for my notes and one because I think it was crazy. So did I hear this correctly? Every thousand you pull out of your 401k in your 20s is like losing 20,000 in retirement.
Yeah. And actually, the math can get worse. It kind of depends on the assumptions that you make. But there's something that when you're a CFP, they have you learn a financial calculator and you do all these calculations. And the first time I did that one, it was like, holy crap. So if you take out $1,000 in your 30s, it's going to cost you like $10,000 in retirement. In your 20s, the toll doubles. It's just crazy. But that's how compounding works. If the money's not there to earn returns, then those returns can't earn returns. And those returns can't earn returns. And if you ever look at one of those charts of compound interest, you know, it's like your account kind of stays the same and it's going up slowly and slowly. And at the end, it shoots up. So you may not think that the money in your 401k, oh, I've only got $5,000. It doesn't matter. If you leave it there and let it grow, it's going to be amazing. You know, when you are ready for retirement, the amounts that you will have are freaking amazing. And I started saving for retirement in my 20s. I didn't know what I was doing. I just knew that 401ks were good, so I started with mine. We had a downturn back then, and I blamed my company. I thought my company had done something to me and taken my money. That's how little I understood about the stock market. But I stayed in there. And, you know, now, at this point in my life, I have options. You know, I can retire. I can take a sabbatical. I can do all these things. When I was younger, you know, I could have a kid and not worry about it. And all this stuff was because I got started early with retirement savings. And I just want to give that to everybody. I want to give that freedom to everybody. That if you do this, you'll have so many more choices when you get older. So please, please, please put some money in a retirement account.
So I just experienced a little bit of acid reflux, and I can't tell if it's because of how much money I've lost from the compound interest or if it's from the pizza that I ate last night. But I'm going to go with the pizza just in case. But go ahead, Marcus.
No, someone was specifically asking, and naturally I'm over here Google searching ad nauseum. And of course, all I'm running into is ads because I'm trying to do it cold. But I remember, or I think I remember, that amount was in your 20s. Someone wrote in and asked, well, how much do I need to save in my 20s to become a millionaire versus my 30s? And it doubles. It's something along the lines of, you know, $416 a month in your 20s to retire as a millionaire as of age 65 in this math. And I think it was like 900 and give up in your 30s or something to that effect. Yeah. And I won't go ahead and speak to the number in your 40s. But yes, that compound interest. Younger millennials, start saving now. Do as I say, not as I did.
Exactly. And anybody who wants to get into the weeds on this, there's a guy named Roger Ibbotson. So Ibbotson, who did something like the, I think it's called the National Retirement Survey. But he did all the math nobody else wants to do. And what he basically came up with is if you, and I'm sorry if you're over 35, but this is the reality. If you start after age 35, it becomes harder and harder and harder to catch up. And to get to where you know, would have been, okay, if you start in your mid 40s, trying to get to where you would have been if you started in your mid 20s, you know, you might be having to save 25, 30% of your income, trying to match what you could have saved with 10%. In your 20s. So I'm sorry if that's getting a little confusing with all the numbers, but basically just keep in mind, it gets harder and harder the longer you wait. So don't wait.
Definitely. Yeah. I found one scale, and folks, I'll get this to you in the show notes, but just to give you an annual amount, and no, I'm not about to divide this by 12 in my head. So good luck. Whip out your calculators. And here we go. Age 20, it is $35,000 annually. Age 25, $5,000, $10 annually. Age 30, it's $7,234. And just to give some approximations, I'm going to skip by age 45 to retire a millionaire at age 65. You would need to save $24,394 annually. Welcome to 50, you'd have to save $39,795. So I think the moral of the story here is at age 20, you might want to start with that $3,500 amount. It's not that much. And then divide that by 12.
There it is.
Yep. Much, much easier. I know it doesn't feel like it. You got other things you want to do. You got your student loans. You got credit card debt, maybe. It's important. Make room for it.
Yeah, this is that part where I start to get mad at young people because I'm over here dividing 3,500 by 12, and I'm like these ungrateful kids.
Get off my lawn.
So it all makes sense to me. The youth is wasted on the young.
Well, and we all make mistakes, too. That's the other thing to keep in mind is all these people who are lecturing you, millennials, you know, they've made mistakes too. And they had a different economy. They had a different life. There was a millennial who was saying, you know, we want affordable education and affordable healthcare, and you call us spoiled, but you had it. You know, those baby boomers did have affordable education and affordable healthcare. And things have changed a lot since they were young, and they need to keep that in mind. And they also need to remember when they were young, the greatest generation, the older generation, was telling them that they were spoiled and entitled and didn't want to work. And, you know, all the things that they're saying about millennials now were said about them.
Huh. Those baby boomers, a bunch of rabble rousers. Is there any social media that you'd like to plug or websites?
My own website is AskLizWeston.com. I write for NerdWallet, which has like boku information about finances, and then we have tools and all kinds of cool stuff. NerdWallet.com. I'm on Twitter at Liz Weston and on Facebook. So yeah, wherever you want to follow me, that would be great.
Awesome. Awesome. So Liz, it's been great having you on the podcast. So much information. Marcus, good luck with those show notes, because I was trying to jot down a lot here. I'm sure you probably jotted down a lot, and I'm sure the listeners are going to get a lot from this one. So thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, guys. Thanks for the invitation.
So as promised, that was a pretty thorough discussion on all things credit scores. And then some of the other stuff we talked about was also new information to me. So I was taking a lot of notes. I really do feel bad for you when it comes time to write the show notes for this one, fam.
Yeah, this was a record breaker. I have almost as many pages as there are apparently credit scores out there of notes that I got to get in. But I'm going to deliver for the people. So hold me accountable. Make sure I don't miss anything. Email me directly if there's a link, hyperlink, page, website, because there was a lot that I didn't get to, and I'll get it out to y'all. Marcus at just to hold accountable to that promise there, Marcus at paycheckbalances.com.
Your email might get blown up, but that's okay. So yeah, we want to thank everyone for listening. Don't forget to join our email list, where we share helpful stories we read throughout the week, actionable work and money tips, and more. You can sign up by visiting paycheckbalances.com/email.
And if you've been enjoying the show, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. If you don't know how, visit paycheckbalances.com/review.
Until next time, be safe. We out. Peace.